is reconvened. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good morning. We're delighted to welcome University of Wisconsin law students. Would they stand, please? Thank you. And we have Marquette University law students. Would they stand? We also have Whitewater High School students. Would they stand, please? Thank you for coming. The high school students are here with a program that is sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and the Supreme Court. Under this program, high school students are invited to come to the court and hear an oral argument. And if they agree to come, they're given briefs in the case that we are about to hear and may engage in other activities relating to that case. And as part of that program, at the end of this oral argument, the students meet with a justice of the Supreme Court and discuss the procedures of the court in taking and hearing cases. The discussion is not on the substance of the case they're about to hear. Everyone is welcome to this discussion at noon. It is not limited to the high school students. Everybody is welcome. Let me introduce the court to you all. Starting on my far left is Justice Lewis Butler. Justice Butler is the justice with whom you will meet at noon. Seated next to him is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice John Wilcox, and to his right, Justice Pat Crooks. And on the far right, Justice Patience Rogensack. I really do know them quite well.
I think I should turn it around with the name tag.
Right. With those introductions badly made, I will call our second case for today, 2005 AP 1507, State versus William F. Schweda. Arguing on behalf of Mr. Schweda is Attorney John E. Machalock. And then we'll have 30 minutes from Assistant Attorney General Joanne Kloppenberg, and then you will have 5 minutes in rebuttal, counsel. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Chief Justice Abrahamson, members of the court, may it please the court. My name is John Machalock. I represent ECI, Bill and Jeff Schweda, who are the appellants in this case. This is my first time ever before you in nearly 30 years, and I'm both honored and humbled to be in front of you on such an important issue to me as a trial lawyer, and I think to others in the practice as well. And the issue, of course, is the right to a jury trial. And this case, which I will detail the facts shortly, but is a case where the state of Wisconsin, with all its power and might, has come down upon ECI and two brothers who bought this company, owned it for 13 months, and assessed them with close to $365,000 in fines, damages, assessments.
Counselor, is the judgment personal to the individuals or just against the corporation?
All three.
All three. Thank you.
Counsel, also, I know that this case involved thousands of counts. All right. My question is, and maybe you'll answer this later on, how a jury could function with that many issues, or perhaps they were all duplicitous. Was there a lot of, were the counts the same, it was just on different days, or what?
I think, first of all, in the number of counts involved, there were basically 15 claims. The number of counts, and there were a total of approximately between 2,000 and 3,000 counts.
Yeah.
But they've broken down. A lot of the counts were assessed for so many days of this particular type of violation or this particular type of discharge. So they were grouped for purposes of trial. To answer the general question of how a jury could comprehend something like this, I would point to two things. If you look at the very decision made by the trial court in this matter, the trial judge remarked when he struck the jury trial and when he was hearing motions on the case that this was a case with a lot of issues well suited to a jury. So the trial judge seemed to think that too, though alluding to the fact that his interpretation of the law was jury trial was required. Second of all, in my own experience, I have tried cases, and I do a lot of work in the commercial area. I have tried cases on the appropriateness of unemployment compensation or workman compensation ratings for the state. I've tried these cases to a jury. I have never found a case in my entire career that you could not interest a jury in and present well enough to have a jury deal with it.
Well, the other question I have is more to inform me. I assume that this untreated waste, was this coming from, like, where they were pumping, I'm just going to say septic tanks or something like that?
No. What they were is a licensed and permitted waste treatment facility. It the state and the city permitted them to pick up waste from industries, other companies.
This was industrial waste. All right. Thank you.
But pre-treated to certain levels, and then they were authorized to discharge it into the sewer system. If I might, before to kind of set the stage here, I would ask the court to consider this case from the standpoint of why were the Schwedas denied a jury trial? I mean, if you were really going back to the point in time of what our constitutional founders thought, there are a couple of things, general remarks. One was by the late Justice William Rehnquist in Park Lane Hosiery. Quoting Justice Holmes, he said the following: "The founders of our nation considered the right of trial by jury in civil cases an important bulwark against tyranny and corruption, a safeguard too precious to be left to the whim of the sovereign, or might it be added to that of the judiciary. Those who passionately advocated the right to a civil jury trial did not do so because they considered the jury a familiar procedural device that should be continued. The concerns for the institution of the jury that led to the passages of the Declaration of Independence and the Seventh Amendment were not animated by a belief that the use of juries would lead to more efficient judicial administration. Trial by jury of laymen rather than by sovereign judges was important to the founders because juries represent the layman's common sense, the passionate elements in our nature, and thus keep the administration of law in accord with the wishes and feelings of the community. Those who favor juries believe that a jury would reach a result that the judge either could not or would not reach." Talking about our Wisconsin founders, which this court has done in all the cases that address this issue, Justice Crooks, writing for the court, cited a Charles Lacon, who is at the Constitutional Convention at the state of Wisconsin. I will not give the court the entire quote. But part of it summarizes the substance of it. "Confidence," this is what one of our state of Wisconsin founders had to say, "confident am I that every free man would like to be able to say to every usurper, thus far shalt thou come, and when you step over the line which divides you from the jury box, you tread upon great hallowed and rendered sacred by the genius of the Constitution." With that as a background, I think the court, and I think it's an appropriate lead to this, on the court's test in Village Food, because the court is trying to, in its decisions, go back to the time to determine what the founders would have thought, how they would have dealt with a case like this. The fact that this court departed from the Ameritech case suggests to me and to every other practitioner that you have to get back into what the spirit of the law was back at the time of their founders. With that, the Village Foods case enunciated a two-part test for whether when the right to jury trial is challenged. The court said the cause of action created by, one, the cause of action created by the statute existed, was known, or was recognized at common law at the time of the adoption of the Wisconsin Constitution in 1848, and two, the action was regarded at law in 1848. Those were the two tests. I think that this case, when I compare Village Food, it beats both of them.
I ask this counsel. I am just not familiar with jury trials in environmental cases. That's my ignorance. But we're dealing with Chapter 281, 283, 289, 291. Are you familiar with any jury trials under any of the statutes in these chapters?
I can't say that I am, but I can't say that it means much. I mean, my breadth of experience in environmental litigation is more limited than in general commercial litigation.
We have to kind of look back, consider nuisance, try to determine whether things that were happening in 1848 have a contemporary counterpart. And if we say they do, we would be creating, as I understand it, a constitutional right to a jury trial in a vast array of environmental cases. I mean, what are the implications of that to environmental regulation?
Well, I would say the implications for both sides would be good. I mean, I don't see the jury trial as an obstruction of justice. I look at it as a constitutional right that has been passed down by our founders. I mean, I think when you look at what citizens do in government today, what they do when they participate in a jury trial, I can't say that a citizen has ever had more direct participation in government than when they participate in a jury trial. To have a jury consider environmental issues, again, brings some sense of the community, brings some sense of the parties that are involved in that type of litigation, that they're being dealt with fairly by their peers. I find that people, when they go through a trial, when they go through a jury trial versus a court trial, they're more accepting of a judgment of their peers. Now, if that's the type of social climate that we want to have, that is such a fabric in our Constitution, but that's the type of social fabric we now need to promote, not to diminish. I mean, if you look at the situation, the facts in this particular case, ECI, you have two brothers that acquire a small facility that treats customer waste and discharges it. They bought it from the founder, who had been operating it for another number of years, had no problems with it.
Just a little bit this way.
Oh, sorry.
Yes, run the microphone because you're being recorded.
I'm sorry. But they bought it for the first months that they had it. They didn't get any notices that there were dramatic violations. What did in fact happen in this case was that the city of Fond du Lac was attacked by the DNR for doing a very poor job in monitoring, not just ECI, Mercury Marine, other big, huge industrial users in Fond du Lac area. Our case was that these people were horribly singled out in the following year to be made a scapegoat for a lot of sins that Fond du Lac were guilty of. In fact, the state sued Fond du Lac the same time it sued ECI filed a stipulation the same day, said we're going to settle with all the violations, which included more than ECI, with the city of Fond du Lac for $25,000, and then we have a stipulation that will jointly go after ECI. And from there, there's stuff in the papers. It was a horrible case in terms of these people being made a scapegoat. The number of counts that the justice referred to earlier, well, look at even the trial court, and perhaps you would have said the same on directed verdict, when of 2,900 counts that we started with, by the time the trial judge sifted down through them, and dismissed ones that were inappropriate, we were down to 529 counts.
Oh, and still, you've handled jury trials, and I have, too. I used to be a trial judge. That's a question I have, but just to follow up on Justice Prosser's, you have to try to fit yourself under Village Foods, which is the, let's say, the seminal case in this area. You have to look back to what was the law in, say, 1848. Now, you mentioned Village Foods in your opening. How do you feel that you fit under Village Foods here?
Okay. Under the first prong of the test, we have to determine whether this was a cause of action or a type of cause of action that existed back in 1848. As we have briefed it, nuisance fits the bill. I mean, a nuisance action all the commentators, including those cited by the Court of Appeals, say that that it was a precursor to the modern environmental law. And this court said in Village Food, you look for not identity, you look for the forerunner, you look for action similar in nature. Well, I think the nuisance action, the public nuisance action, is so similar in nature that it's even codified. If you look at the statute, .299.95, the legislature has even said, for purposes of this proceeding, where chapters 281 to 285 and 289 to 295, or this chapter, or the rule, or special order, license, plan, approval, permit, or certification prohibits in whole or part any pollution, a violation is considered a public nuisance. I mean, that's a word of art that has been around, as the Court of Appeals pointed out, since the beginning of time, as well as lawyers are concerned. And you look at the Village Foods case, where did the court go to find out what the common law was before the time of the Constitution? It went to Blackstone. It went to Chapter 4 of Blackstone and looked for laws on following the market. I don't remember all the precise terms, but it went to Blackstone. If you go to Blackstone one chapter earlier in Chapter 3, you find the public nuisance action. It's going to the same treatise that this court did in Village Food. So you've got that, and you've got the statute, and you've got Prosser, and you've got other commentators that we cited in our briefs. It's really, and you've got modern commentary saying that all the environmental laws on the books really hark back to the nuisance law, where they were first enforced. And if you go back to some of those old cases, you know, the science may have changed a little, but people were considering whether discharge or some sort of fouly water was causing malaria. I mean, they were not deprived of science. They were juries considering these issues, not deprived of the science of the time.
Mr. McLack, were the cases that you're referring to, are the types of actions that existed at the time of the founding of the Constitution, were those considered cases at law or cases at equity?
I believe that they were cases at law. Certainly, the public nuisance action commenced by the state The common law crime of public nuisance was commenced by indictment, which would be a crime. There's a statute placed on the books in 1849 that says that that allows both an action at law and an action in equity. I think one of those very good commentaries that was cited by the Court of Appeals says that in the 19th century there was flux in the law, but I think the flux was going in this direction, and I say this by reading the railroad case, the one, the very long case from the Supreme Court on the challenge of Northwestern Railroads. I think earlier in the century, people really did prosecute nuisances private nuisances by actions for damages, and by fines by the state. And if it didn't work, I mean, the injunction was kind of like came later, and that's why it was starting to be added by statute. I think if you read the railroad case, by 1879, the injunction was there as a remedy because the courts were saying you keep suing for the same party over and over again, you know, for the same thing. Eventually, you have to add on some sort of relief. I think the early injunction statutes were kind of precursor to that. But if you look what came first on the thing, I think it would be the common law action. And the fact that there were three is very well stated.
The fact that there were what? I didn't hear
three,
that.
I'm sorry. The fact that there were indictment, common law cause of action, and action in equity was very well stated in the Shepherdson case. It's one of the early ones to the cited by the Court of Appeals, but it's referred to in the Douglas case, which we referred to in our reply brief. If you look at the Douglas case, albeit it's a case that's in the early 1850s, it's proceeding on an indictment for common law nuisance. And there, the judge is talking about the type of jury instructions to give. And
Counsel, why isn't it as simple as this? That if it's a criminal action, of course you get a jury. If it's a private nuisance, you have damages and it's at law. If it's a public nuisance, it's an equity.
Well,
why isn't it that, looking at the case law, I mean, and I, in part, I'm relying on the cases that are set forth in the certification of the Court of Appeals.
Okay. I think because there's, if you go, again, if you go back to what this Court has said in Village Food,
yeah.
If you look at the early case that the Court compared, or the early Blackstone sections that the Court compared with, there are criminal statutes. The Court there determined that when you're looking at a civil cause of action by somebody under the minimum markup law, did it matter there that it was a civil cause of action versus a criminal cause of action? The Court answered the question, no. It said that as long as that type of cause of action existed back in 1848 where people would have an expectation of a jury trial, that was sufficient. In Village Food, the Court didn't go through the dichotomy of saying that one was criminal and now we're dealing with a civil case. And frankly, there is the way I look at it, a purely equitable action, or an action just purely for an injunction would be what I would regard as a purely equitable action. An action for damages, civil, is an action at law. That's stated clearly in every case. An action for forfeiture, the case law says, is an action at law. An action by indictment for public nuisance is an action at law.
It seems to me, and I don't have my mind around it, but you're talking about an action for certain remedies. And that you seem to be focusing on the remedies, yet the test in Village Food isn't remedies, but whether or not the action was regarded at law. So the focus doesn't seem to be on the remedies, but the nature of the action in the village food test. Am I right or wrong?
This is exactly what the court said. The court in the second part of the test, I thought I misunderstood the court to say that we tried to see whether or not it was regarded at law, back in 1848. And to me, there's no question that this one was.
Counsel, what about this idea or just the thought? Here, the first offense, first time, it's a civil action. And then when you look at Wisconsin Statute 283.91, it says, but if it's a following, it could be a criminal action. Does that make any difference?
Well, I think...
In other words, you'd be entitled to a jury trial if there was a further violation. But the first time through, it says, well, it's civil. Does that bring all of it into possibly the jury realm?
I think there's three subparts to that statute that you're referring to. There's one that says the state can bring a criminal action. There's two that the state can bring a civil action for forfeiture, and three that the state could go for an injunction. Now, I think if you're dealing with a purely injunctive relief, then you're harking back to the equitable powers of the court. But I think on number one and number two, you're talking about an action at law, because this court has consistently held that an action for forfeitures is an action at law. And to me, just mentally, there's a big difference between enjoining something in the future and penalizing something from the past. I mean, this is almost like a quasi-criminal action. On the facts of this case, these defendants got so beat up that they shut down their operation in a year. I mean, they went back and they tried to work with the city, and it was untenable. They decided to disband their business. Everybody walked away from this for a year. A year later, they get, at the same time, the city gets sued, they get sued. And all that time has gone by with nothing. In the Douglas case, where the court does refer to Walker versus Shepherdson, you hark back to a case that's however many years old, from 1853, but I still think it has bearing. I mean, you look at that statute, you do, and you think... It summarizes the remedies for a nuisance. It says a person could be indicted for a public nuisance. It says that where the acts which create the public nuisance cause also private and special injury to the plaintiff, that action at law will lie. I see I'm out of time.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Assistant Attorney General Joanne Kloppenberg, arguing for the state of Wisconsin. Counsel?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I am Assistant Attorney General Joanne Kloppenberg for the plaintiff state of Wisconsin. This court should find that the current statutory regime of regulation to prevent pollution is, in the words used in paragraph 14 of Village Food, a new statutory scheme to provide environmental protection that has no counterpart in any action existing, known, or recognized in 1848, neither in any statutory action nor in any nuisance action, whether brought before courts in law or equity. Indeed, it is because the common law nuisance, which could be brought only against existing or imminent actual harms, proved ineffective at addressing, controlling, and correcting the kinds of pollution that accompanied industrial development and technological innovation, that, confronted with burning rivers or closer to home, an unfishable and unswimmable Wisconsin River, the federal and state governments finally acted in the 1970s to create new statutory environmental protection programs. Common law nuisance did not address the large-scale pollution problem that industrial development had presented.
Well, then, Ms. Kloppenberg, the rules of the road in the 1840s dealing with the horses and horse and buggy didn't address the elaborate motor vehicle codes we have now. And yet the court said the rules of the road are close enough. I mean, if you take what I hear you saying, nothing's going to be a jury trial except criminal law.
Well,
I've overstated the position, but it comes close to that.
No, I think not, Your Honor. I think both in Village Food and in McGrew, the activity there, whether it be predatory pricing or risky travel, regardless of the means used, were actionable under the common law at statehood. And the actions were effective at combating those activities.
But at common law, if somebody caused noise, smell, obnoxious material on your property, they were all compatible. Might not have been as effective and detailed as your statutory scheme is, but you could sue in trespass, you could sue in nuisance, public or private.
But you could sue, Your Honor, only after the harm took place. None of the claims in this case, none of the claims in most environmental enforcement actions would have been actionable in nuisance because they haven't created the harm yet that's necessary to show a nuisance. The activity that was attacked in Village Food and in McGrew could have been actionable then as it is now. If you had, in this case, for example, the city did not shut down ECI. It rescinded its permit. A permit was something unheard of at common law at statehood. The violation is discharge without a permit. The remedy is to come together to put forth a plan with trained personnel, with proper operational processes that entitle you to a permit to continue discharging. That's different from both the action and the remedy available should you actually go so far as to sully someone's well or poison their air.
So why would you revoke the permit, rescind the permit?
In this case, the city acted to rescind the permit because based on the 3 months prior showings of exceedances of the discharge limitations in their permit and their inability to produce compliant samples, they determined that the facility did not have in place the trained personnel or operations that would allow it to operate in compliance. But it could have acquired that expertise, and it could have applied for and obtained a new permit and continued to discharge. Another point that this court should consider in applying the Village Food test.
Do we have to look at each of the claims or items? Because some might be a public nuisance or a private nuisance.
No, I think Village Food tells us to look broadly, and I think you have to look broadly at the environmental protection scheme.
Well, when you say broadly, I wrote the dissent. Well, I concurred also in Village Foods, but I was just looking at the, it seems to me that Village Foods, the whole idea was a much broader test. And it looked back at the constitutional days, 1848, and if there was a, quote, similarity that under Village Foods, now you tell me if I'm wrong, it seemed that that would come under what they assumed, strike that, what they thought would be a jury trial. What a jury trial. Isn't that what Village Foods did?
Well, Your Honor, I have to make Village Food work.
Well, for you.
For me. And I believe that you, I do.
It didn't work for me. You know that. So.
That's okay, too.
That's okay, too.
Okay.
I believe it would be unworkable to dissect every claim and see whether, in fact, there was already a public nuisance here. Again, even if they had, in this case, they were actually discharging beyond their limits, but there was no provable harm to Lake Winnebago. They weren't discharging to a water of the state, so there couldn't have even been a public nuisance action back at statehood because they were discharging just to a city sewer system. So you have to stand back and say, where are all these claims coming from? They're coming from a statutory scheme directed at preventing harm to the environment.
Run that by me again, because it's discharging into a public sewer system is different than...
They're not directly discharging into the waters of the state. They're discharging into the sewer system that then treats these waters and then discharges to the lake.
I'm just picking up on the fact that it seems to me the city is the public.
Well, there are a couple old cases that I think would place the city as a possible plaintiff in a private nuisance action because it's their treatment plant that was affected. But neither they nor the state was able in this case to prove direct harm to the lake. All of these permit requirements were directed at preventing harm to the lake, and fortunately, the violations were caught before that harm was able to be proven. Justice Prosser asked about jury trials in environmental cases. Well, there are other environmental statutes wrapped up in chapters 29, 30, and 31, and I think those are instructive because the legislature has provided by statute in section 23.50 and 23.77 a right to a jury trial in all actions in chapters 29, 30, and 31. Chapter 31 regulates dams. It turns out now that there were public nuisance crimes prosecuted by indictment. We have an example of two. In this regard, the state's brief is incomplete. Blackstone does say that you could prosecute nuisances by indictment. I was not aware of any. The defendants have identified two dam cases from the 1850s, Douglas and Stoughton. Well, dams now, and in both those cases, the dams overflowed and flooded surrounding areas. Dam cases are now regulated under Chapter 31. I think it's significant that here, the legislature, by statute, provided for a jury to cover claims, well, to cover matters that were actionable as public nuisance crimes in the 1850s under our current statutory scheme of environmental protection. I think by analogy, we can say that here, too, the legislature could act to extend that right to a jury, to all of the other environmental statutes for which we found no common law actions under public nuisance.
Are you saying that with respect to chapters 281, 283, 289, and 291, that there are no jury trials related to those chapters?
All of the civil enforcement actions that can be taken under those statutes, that's what I'm saying, Your Honor.
But how would the criminal actions be different? Obviously, they're criminal, but, I mean, isn't the underlying conduct that's being prosecuted the same?
In almost all of the statutes, some of the statutes don't have criminal violations. The Chapter 292 and the solid waste, I think Chapter 287, do not have criminal enforcement provisions, nor I think does Chapter 281. I think only 283 does, which is wastewater and hazardous waste and air. They have criminal provisions.
Can I just interrupt?
Yes.
Because I asked your opposing counsel that question. Now, here you have civil and criminal remedies. And it would seem to me where you're dealing, if there's another violation, you correct me if I'm wrong, then it could be criminal.
No, in most of the cases, it depends on intent.
It depends on intent.
State of mind. You have to have additional. It has to be.
So it could have been. Well, let me just. Then it could have been, if it was their intent the first time, it could have been criminal. But you charged them civilly, so you had the choice there. Does that make any difference when, under the other statutes, there isn't that criminal remedy? Here there is.
No, Your Honor, I believe it doesn't, because the village food test focuses not on the ultimate remedy, but on the nature of the action. And here, the nature of environmental protection actions that they didn't exist at statehood. However, regardless of that, once you get into criminal prosecution, you're entitled to a right to a jury under a different amendment of the Constitution. For crimes, you get juries. But that shouldn't alter the village food analysis that requires you to focus on the nature of the cause of action before the court.
I guess it just seems odd to me, not maybe to the rest of my colleagues, that you have, and it's a state's choice, you can charge, not have a jury trial, or you can charge differently, and it all depends upon how you're the prosecutor, see the case.
Well, the rules are different in criminal trials.
Oh, I know that.
Yes. The protections afforded by a jury are more greatly needed, for sure, in criminal trials, but then you're changing the test. So that any time the legislature sets up a new statutory scheme, as long as it provides both criminal and civil enforcement alternatives, you get a jury. And I don't think that's what...
Well, it wasn't my intention to infer that, but it was just that if should there be another test, we've got village foods, you're relying on that. Maybe that's a test that shouldn't always be used.
That may be, but that's for you all
to
determine, not me.
You're not suggesting we change the test.
Yes.
No, as I have interpreted it, I believe that it means that here there is no right to a jury trial. I do agree that it is harder to apply than the Ameritech test, and maybe less easy to understand at face value than the Ameritech test, but I think we were able to work through it and make it work in the circuit court here as we tried to analyze whether there was a right to a jury.
Could I ask you a question? I'm going to read from page 9 of the opposing counsel's brief. The city and the DNR claim that in August 2002, they discovered sludge behind ECI's facility and on a neighboring property. DNR accused ECI of dumping the sludge, which ECI denied. That's sludge or dumping something on this property and going over to this property. That just gives me a picture of a nuisance action. Yes or no?
Well, the sludge in this case, and we had photographs of it, and the claim was under our spills law, Chapter 292, for discharging a hazardous substance into the environment. And it had not yet, it was an encroachment on actually an ATV trail, on a public trail. And it was on their own property. On their own property, it wasn't a nuisance to anyone. It had killed the vegetation under it. But once it was removed, that vegetation could recover. But it didn't amount... Was it a trespass on the public property? I suppose it was, but I don't think those are the kind... I haven't found any actions like that that were brought in public nuisance by...
Now, your opposing counsel cited Wisconsin Statute 299.95, and it basically says all of these statutes
This is a public nuisance.
How are you going to explain that?
Well, I think that's an indication that the legislature recognized it was doing something new, that it was going beyond the kind of conduct that old nuisance law could reach, because it's saying now that any violation of these statutes, the failure to file a report, the failure to obtain a permit, anything, whether it causes harm or not, if it's a violation of these environmental protection statutes, it is a nuisance, and the state does not have to prove what it would have had to prove its statehood in order to maintain a nuisance action and succeed. It can just say the statute was violated and it's entitled to abatement and injunctive relief. It's interesting that Blackstone said, among other things, that it would not be right for boards of health to be able to just say that this is a nuisance or this is not. And that's why, when it was questionable, the existence of a nuisance could go to a court of law before it was abated in a court of equity. Well, the legislature has done just that. The legislature has said any violation of these statutes is a nuisance. And so it has gone beyond where common law public nuisance actions were able to go.
Kloppenberg, I'm sorry, were you done?
That's
right. I'm a bit curious as to, my understanding is the Swedes wanted to have a jury trial in this action, and the state has opposed that. And I'm a bit curious as to why the state, why you would want to avoid a jury trial in these types of actions. What is the motivation for trying to move this out of the realm of a jury?
It's a fair question, Your Honor. It doesn't come up very often. But here, in this case, it did. And the state moved to dismiss, to strike their request for a jury, both because we believed that that was the law. Under the law, they had no constitutional right, but also, frankly, practically as a matter of resources. We had just come off a motion for summary judgment that the judge had considered and denied. And so the judge in this case had a very comprehensive briefing in the technical context for the case. And both sides were just able to just jump right in, literally a few weeks later, and go to trial without the extra preparations that would have been required to bring a jury up to that level of speed at that point. So it was a matter of resources, as well as our belief that under the law they had no right to a jury trial.
And I guess the thing that concerns me about that, and I understand the first argument, there's no right to a jury trial, there's no right to a jury trial. But it would seem to me that given the language that's in the constitutional provision, shall remain inviolate, and given the way Village Foods and Dane County versus McGrew have been interpreted, that would seem to, on the one hand, take away from a person who wanted a trial the ability to have one, and two, almost say that this is really too complicated for 12 citizens. That's the concern that I have, that we not look at this in a means, and when you say the resources, that concerns me, because that resources argument sounds like an argument of convenience, and that convenience argument sounds like, well, it's easier and it's better if the judge does it than if we have to educate a jury. And that troubles me, and that's why I raised the question.
Well, there's no question that it's not too complicated for a jury. I think the cases on Wall Street and Enron are a whole lot more complicated than an environmental case can ever be. And in fact, we do have jury trials in Chapter 30 and 31 actions. So it would be unsupportable for us to take that position. And so if the legislature saw fit to provide a jury in all of these cases, then that would be fine too.
There is a Chapter 26 in the 1849 statutes that includes, says, of the preservation of public health. And it essentially gives certain government officers all the powers necessary to, quote, examine into all nuisances, sources of filth, and causes of sickness, and make such regulations respecting the same as they may judge necessary for the public health and safety of the inhabitants. You quoted from Blackstone a moment ago. How does this relate to that, and what is the impact of this language on the issue in front of us?
I have two thoughts, Your Honor. One is that Blackstone then went on to say, but the Board of Health can't decide ahead of time what a nuisance is or not. And now the legislature has done that, saying any violation of these statutes is. But also, I think what they're relating to there is what Blackstone himself related, and it's Book 4, Chapter 13, where he lists the public nuisances, and he says that when you get to something that could possibly relate to the public health, that they should be offensive manufacturers and trades. And the whole point is that there was nothing offensive about a wastewater treatment facility. It's only now, if it operates either without a permit or in violation of its permit, that the state has authority to do something about that, whether it can prove it's offensive or not. The state, the Department of Natural Resources, much to the chagrin of many, regulates a whole lot of things that are not on their face offensive, but they do that in order to prevent something offensive from occurring.
Could I just ask, let's say we are 1720, something like that.
Okay.
In merry old England, and there is a public well. And one of my colleagues could be really nasty, drop something in the public well that spoils it, or there's something next door that it's seeping into the well. I mean, how, these people were certainly smart enough to react to that some way. How did they react? What was done?
Well, there was a case, although it was 1914, it was a little older, I mean newer. Carthew versus City of Platteville, where the plaintiff sued for damages for contamination of their well water because the city septic tank was leaking. And the court there, maybe this just shows how confusing the state of nuisance law became, but they said there that the complaint stated one cause of action in equity, because they wanted them to stop polluting their well and they wanted to get damages. So through a private nuisance action, you were able to do that, but it was inequity.
But, I mean, suppose the well is ruined, and the community has to have another well.
Then you would ask for a new well to be dug.
Wasn't that okay? Damages? I mean, let's say the Chief Justice polluted the well. I mean, are we going to have her dig the new well?
It would depend on the circumstances of the case. Back then, perhaps you would order her to hire a contractor to dig a well on your property, or to provide you another source of water, or to give you the money to dig a new well. But that's... But again, we're talking about something that has already proven to be a nuisance.
But clearly we understand injunctions or remedial actions, as you talk about, but there were no damages?
Damages were awarded to private plaintiffs by statute under actions at law once the statutes were passed. But in equity, it appears before then that once... If the plaintiff wanted to abate the injunction or the nuisance, they needed to proceed in a court of equity, and the courts of equity retain their jurisdiction also to award damages. The statute that was passed shortly after and revised after statehood allowed private plaintiffs to pick which court they wanted to go to. But then we're coming, there are no more courts of equity or at law anymore, and for the right to the constitutional right to a jury to depend solely on the relative weight of the remedy that's now asked for, is, I think, unworkable because it will vary from case to case and you won't have a consistent scheme. I think it makes more sense to focus on the first prong and look at the nature of the underlying claim.
I don't want to be silly, but let's say there's some nuisance that affects the land of the king, George III. You're saying the king would never ask for damages for injury to the king's land?
From what I have read, when nuisance started with just that kind of thing, people doing stuff to the king's property, and he could go to the chancery courts and get some equitable relief, or the king could prosecute those as a crime. But it appears that criminal nuisance actions were very rare. It was hard to uncover any, and they're not addressed with much detail in the literature.
Well, we agree a criminal action under the environmental law is going to need a jury, right? All right. Now, do you agree that an injunctive action in the 1850s would not get a jury?
Correct.
In environmental law, right? Now, what about damages in a nuisance case in the 1850s? Would you get a jury? Would you be entitled to a jury?
You could find cases to give you many different answers. There's a line of cases in the state's brief that says that you start with a court of equity and the equity court retains jurisdiction to grant damages. The state could not get damages at all. So only private plaintiffs in private nuisance actions could then instead go to a court of law and get damages.
With a jury?
Yes.
Why doesn't that carry over till today?
Because the kinds of actions they were bringing are not the kinds of actions that we are enforcing here under the environmental statutes.
Are there any kinds of actions that are enforceable today that you think are comparable to the 1850s actions?
Under environmental law?
Mm-hmm. Well, and under any law. What I'm trying to do is you might argue that under environmental statutes, hey, that's just a totally different bag. And that anything in 1850s that dealt with nuisance and pollution and noise and air, et cetera, that they have a counterpart today, but not in the statutory environmental law. Can you argue that or not?
I would argue that the statutory scheme in place today has no counterpart. I believe that there are certain claims in Chapter 30, for example, that prevent the obstruction of navigable waters that clearly stem back to nuisance law, but there's a jury provided by the legislature for those kinds of claims. I think claims in fraud, which would bring in a lot of the causes of action currently under our consumer statutes, fraud clearly was acted against at the common law in front of juries and can still be done so today. I see my time is up.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
There are no more questions?
Any other questions?
Thank you,
Ms. Provenberg. Counsel?
Thank you. To address some of the points, I disagree with the rendition of the facts this was not the causes made against the ECI and the Schwedas were not such that they were causing demonstrable environmental pollution. The one that made the papers certainly comes to mind in Fond du Lac. When Fond du Lac had an upset of its POTW, its treatment plant, and spilled waste into Lake Winnebago, it was my clients who were blamed for, to my mind, very unproven evidence that they were responsible for this by somehow corrupting the sewage treatment plant with surfactants.
So these wastes are disposed, okay, the wastes go into a lake after they're cleaned up, right?
Correct. All the wastes under the whole scheme, my clients would have to treat the wastes at a certain point. The public facility would have, you know, we would go through the public facility and then to the for further treatment and then into the lake. And they had to...
So did the DNR, I'm just asking, there was a problem with the lake?
Correct. Correct. Okay. That because the sewage treatment plant was upset, there was harm done to the lake. There's a mentioned reference was made that some of the claims don't have criminal violations. That is true. But when I went through them, I think we're talking about only one set of claims versus all of them. Most of them have the criminal counterpart to the statute. The one that doesn't is the failure to employ a testing device.
But you know whether it's criminal or civil complaint when you get the complaint.
Correct.
So here it was both. One, some were criminal, some were civil. Which did you ask for a jury in?
I asked for a jury in the civil case. I filed a regular demand in the civil case. Because it was preceded as a civil case. I just followed suit with the rules.
But I want to make sure we don't misunderstand each other. There were no criminal charges filed against
them.
There were criminal counterparts to some of the charges.
Correct.
Is that right?
Correct. Some of the Ms. Kloppenberg is correct. In some of the enforcement statutes, there's 1, 2, and 3 in terms of enforcement, and one may be criminal. In one set of them, there's only the civil, and the only civil applies to me a minor part of the case because it only addresses the failure to install a testing device claims that are presented before the court. The rest have criminal counterparts.
Your opposing counsel said Chapter 292 and Solid Waste 287 do not have criminal sanctions.
Correct. And I think the one and the claims are before the court. It's the one that doesn't have the testing device that would fall into that category. But the others would have criminal counterparts. I hate to refer to them as those damn cases, but I guess I will. the ones that are early 1853 cases. I don't think that there were cases that were, they were definitely nuisance cases. I mean, to quote one section, the judge in substance told the jury that if from the evidence they should find that stenches were caused by causes of disease and that stenches or malaria were increased by the existence of the dam, then that was a nuisance. He cautioned them to guard against the influence of prejudice of their minds and stated that the case was an important one and had been tried once before, that great expense had been incurred, and it is important that they should agree. But it's clearly, you could hear the modern ring to nuisance case, which brings me to a point that you raised, Justice Prosser, I believe earlier, could I think of other cases that are tried to a jury, and I'm thinking like other cases that I've done or friends have done. And I wasn't thinking about other appellate cases. We did cite in our reply brief the fact that in other jurisdictions, parties, individuals charged with viral violations of environmental laws are entitled to a jury trial, and citing Tull versus United States. And I should add here, I don't know if I could finish my response, but I realized when we were preparing for this argument that State of Rhode Island, it's an unpublished case, and it was stated to be unpublished, and it really shouldn't be in here.
Thank you, counsel. I want to thank Mr. Mankaloff and Attorney Kloppenberg for their arguments today on yet another case as to what the Constitution means as to providing for jury trial in civil cases. This ends the hearing on 2005 AP 1507, State versus Schweda et al. Justice Butler will be out momentarily to talk with you all, and other students may be coming in to join you. We are in recess until 1:30.